and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee from America's top intelligence officials who sounded the alarm on Russian interference in this year's election following Russia's successful manipulation of our 2016 election, and speak with Justin Levitt, a professor of law at Loyola Law School and a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. An expert on election law and voting systems, he joins us to discuss whether there is the political will to follow up on the dire warnings from intelligence chiefs, particularly in the White House, where President Trump continues to deny Russian meddling in our politics, which continues to this day. We will also assess whether the threat to our democracy and the 2018 elections could be seen as an opportunity to fix our broken election systems, since the Department of Homeland Security has found that the Russians probed the election systems of 21 states in 2016 and could easily go much further to manipulate results or sow confusion in 2018. Then we'll examine another aspect of testimony today from the intelligence chiefs, with the Director of National Intelligence describing a broken system of issuing security clearances that has a current government-wide backlog of 700,000 applications. There is also a clear double standard in which White House officials and relatives of Donald Trump are quickly given clearances for access to the nation's most secret information, even if the FBI has concerns that arise in background checks. Josh Gerstein, a senior White House reporter for Politico specializing in national security, joins us to discuss his article at Politico, FBI Director Puts Responsibility for Porter on White House, and how a top White House aide like Rob Porter, who was accused of being a wife beater, could be vulnerable to blackmail. Then finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Cole joins us in the studio. He is the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his latest book just out is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll discuss how this secret unit within the ISI, Pakistan's military intelligence, Directorate S, has been thwarting the U.S. at every turn in its 17-year-long slow-motion military and political disaster in Afghanistan. And joining us now is Justin Levitt, who is an Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law and was formerly a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Levitt.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, Justin. And today, the intelligence chiefs, the head of the FBI, the director of national intelligence and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the head of the NSA, along with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and the director of Central Intelligence as well, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Dan Coats, the DNI, talking about the Russian hacking of 2016 and how they will repeat it again in this year's election in 2018 because it worked out so well for them in 2016. Coates said today, "We expect Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, false flag personas, sympathetic spokesmen, and other means to influence to try and build on its wide range of operations and exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States." So the question would be, since you're an expert on election law and the machinery, if you will, of elections, this wouldn't be happening if our systems weren't so broken and easy to penetrate, would it, Justin?
I don't know. I'm skeptical about that, if only because the very things that you just mentioned, it's easy to conflate. The very things that you just mentioned, there are two different sources of very serious concern. One is with, as you put it, the machinery, the how we cast and count ballots. That includes registration systems, that includes voting machines, that includes, you know, the nitty-gritty of casting a ballot and making sure that it's properly counted. And there are some safeguards there. There's always a need to make things more secure, and the various points of security vary depending on what stage and what state you're talking about. Everything that you just mentioned from the hearing today, though, false flag personas, fissures in the American public, propaganda, and things like that, that has more to do with hacking us than it does hacking mechanical systems. which is equally of concern, in fact, should be of greater concern, because it's much tougher to defeat with technological measures. It is known that foreign entities, including those suspected to be from Russia, attempted to penetrate the machinery, but were largely unsuccessful in 2016. It is also known that foreign entities, including those affiliated with Russia, attempted to misdirect us, to sow confusion and dissent and false information. And at that, they were wildly successful, I think, beyond both their and our imagination. And that is a very serious concern coming into 2018 as well.
Well, the Department of Homeland Security, though, said that Russians tried to hack into the voting systems of 21 states. Now, as far as I know, these were more probing. They weren't really attacks so much as getting into the opening the door, but they were kind of picking the lock, to use a kind of metaphor. Is that your understanding?
It is, and you know what I'm saying here reflects only the information that we know publicly. There may well be more behind that, and there have consistently been very real efforts to inform the public in this way without disclosing truly classified materials. To use your metaphor, there were attempts to pick the lock of 21 different states. Only one worked, and it only worked sort of. It worked well enough to give foreign entities a look-see into voter registration processes in Illinois. There's no indication that any data was altered in Illinois, and there's no indication that any of the other states saw an attack that was effective. There were attempts. They were largely robust, and they were mostly targeting the voter registration systems. There were other attempts targeting some of voting machine software updates. Those relied, again, on human weaknesses rather than technological ones. They relied on phishing attacks, the same sort of spam that we've had warnings about, we keep getting warnings about. Don't click on mysterious links. Don't open documents if you don't know where they're from. Those sorts of phishing attacks we saw attempted in a number of different counties with the people whose job it was to maintain some of the voting systems, among other things. As far as we know, most of those attempts, too, were unsuccessful. That's not to say, by the way, that we should rest on a relative ability to rebuff the attempts of 2016. So the fact that they were poking around 21 state doors should be room for serious concern. And there are, in fact, measures that states are generally attempting to take, sometimes with the assistance of the federal government. They could use a lot more money and support to that end, to reinforcing the locks on those doors.
But it's conceivable that the Russians, the FSB and the GRU, the intelligence services, basically were doing so well with other active measures because the Russians have perfected influence campaigns. And it's a sort of low-level, non-kinetic, as they say, form of warfare, which they've hybrid warfare, which they seem to have perfected. And they did so well with other means that we've learned about from the intelligence communities, particularly in those three states that were critical to Trump's victory, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. For example, Jill Stein got more votes in those states than Hillary lost by. And she was obviously a part of an influence campaign with RT, of course, held the Green Party debates. She was sitting at the table with Putin and General Flynn. And by the way, also at the table was Julian Assange's father. And according to the Steele dossier, she was a part of an active, and probably what they called Bolotnik, the Durak, a useful idiot, not aware of how much she was being used. So I don't think we could take any comfort from the fact that they only picked the locks. Maybe they didn't intend to open the door.
Well, so your point is good. We should enhance all of the security measures wherever we can without impacting eligible voters. And most of these fixes that people have in mind, most of the cyber defenses that people have in mind, are exactly the sort that should be drawing bipartisan support and resources. You're also right to point out the ways in which Russia manipulated our the information we receive, the issues we care about, the information that we use to make decisions, and both forms of hacking, if you will, or both forms of election interference, do have a common deterrent at their core, even beyond electronically inoculating the voting systems and informationally inoculating us. One thing that we know that deters interference in elections is making abundantly clear that such interference will not be tolerated by the entities responsible for statecraft and defense. That is, interference in elections is tantamount to a war footing. And we have been mealy-mouthed, I think, at the highest levels of government, strangely in a way that we've not seen out of senators or members of Congress or agency heads. We've been mealy-mouthed about calling out the Russian interference for what it really was, as an act of sabotaging our domestic election process. And the strongest deterrent may well be one that is not technological, or one that's not reliant on changes in state laws, but one that relies on sanctions and other means of international deterrence, the very same way that we would very quickly react to Russians massing troops on our borders.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Levitt, who's an Associate Dean for Research and a Professor of Law at Loyola University's Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law and was formerly a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. But of course, the Russian influence campaign continues to this day. It was Russian bots and troll farms that were pushing the hashtag release the memo, along with Fox News and others. I'm talking about the Nunes memo, and that was just, what, a couple of weeks ago. So they are still actively influencing Americans via social media. But to the point that you just made, Justin, Senator Angus King, the independent of Maine, he, in the hearings today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, he urged the heads of America's intelligence agencies to lean on the president and try and educate President Trump. Quoting Angus King, "My problem is I talk to people in Maine who say the whole thing is a witch hunt and a hoax because the president told me." So that seems to me to be a major problem, isn't it? If, you know, we're learning lately, we have been learning since the last year, the enormous power in the executive branch. This is a president who is very actively doing stuff his way and not the traditional way. And a lot of people are alarmed by how much he's accomplishing.
Well, they should be alarmed, particularly at the devaluation of the democratic system we have and of the devaluation of national defense. You know, he has claimed to want to support the military and he has claimed to want to support the national defense. There is a bill that Congress has passed that requires him to execute sanctions that is now overdue. Those sanctions were passed in response to the Russian 2016 election campaign, and it seems to be a shocking lack of a priority for the president to implement what Congress has told him to do, at least as a bare initial step in responding. Then, of course, there are the concerns about devaluing what we know about Russian interference, devaluing the assessments of the intelligence community, devaluing the assessments of the law enforcement community, because it is impossible to mobilize the country on a footing responding to international attacks if the country does not agree that we were internationally attacked. That's one of the more devious aspects of the interference campaign in 2016. If there were a physical attack, if there were a bomb placed, if there were a missile launched, the country would demand action. And I think, even in these polarized days, that Americans of all stripes would similarly demand action. The conclusions of our law enforcement entities and of our intelligence entities is that we were attacked. It just didn't have to do with a bomb or a missile. And the consistent campaign to undermine America's belief that we were attacked is quite destructive.
Well, today the head of the CIA, Pompeo, told the Senate Intelligence Committee that the CIA had already, and quoting him, seen Russian activity and intentions to have an impact on the next election cycle here. And then he went on to say that the U.S. could respond to any Russian meddling in our elections with offensive cyber capabilities, quoting Pompeo. We do have some capability offensively to raise the cost for those who would dare challenge the United States election. And that, of course, Mike Rogers is in charge of Cyber Command. I don't know. I don't have any quotes from him, the head of the NSA, who basically everybody wanted to fire him because of Snowden and because of the other massive leak to the shadow brokers. But I'd be interested to get your opinion on that. I mean, the shadow brokers material, for example, the hacking tools, the NSA and the CIA hacking tools now give Russia and China enormous capabilities. They could basically shut down everything in this country. So that's a trigger that maybe you don't want to pull, right? Offensive cyber warfare, because the ability to retaliate is so awesome.
Well, so that's right. And there is massive ability to retaliate against action that we take. But I'll point out that we have been attacked. Normally, when a country has been attacked by another state entity, it endeavors to deter further such attacks. There are gradations, obviously. There are economic, there are military, there are cyber military. There are a number of other steps. There are diplomatic steps. It seems, at least, that the heads of the intelligence agencies, that the heads of the law enforcement agencies, that we haven't heard quite as much from the Secretary of State on this issue, but he too has expressed concern, which is more than is coming from the leadership of the executive branch as a whole, from the president, about using some of these capabilities to deter further incursions into the domestic American process by foreign actors, including specifically by foreign states. I mean, this is it is not unheard of, but normally when this happens, there is a strong effort to deter further interference. And I should add Congress to that list. Like I said, Congress passed sanctions on Russia, in part as an effort to supplement the existing ongoing deterrence. And the president, as I understand it, has yet to implement those sanctions. That, too, should be very concerning. But I also don't want to put all of this on the president. His absence of action is concerning for sure. But as we've just discussed, Russia's main ability to influence the American election process is through us. It's by getting us to believe incorrect information. It's by pitting us against each other. It's by directing our focus where it shouldn't be. And there are ways to deter such efforts from Russia, but there are also ways to inoculate us against the ability to be manipulated quite so easily. The more that we each do in assessing the sources of our news, in trying to come to a common understanding of facts in the world, of being a little bit skeptical at statements by political leaders of both party and by no party, and by reasoning through the information that we are given, that actually will help inoculate us against further attack by misinformation. Perhaps better than any other deterrence would do.
Well, it does seem, though, that the fixes are not just technical, that they're also political. And it does seem that the Republicans want to have it both ways. They're always screaming from the rafters about election security and election fraud, which is they had a whole commission under Chris Kobach that they finally had to dissolve because it went nowhere. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, we've got to get rid of election fraud and do nothing about interference from the Russians, which the intelligence chiefs just warned us could happen. It will happen again in this year's election and could be infinitely more aggressive than the last time around. But it does seem that we have these political opportunities to do things. They somehow get sidetracked by partisan politics. After the Florida meltdown in 2000, a lot of attention was paid to fixing our election system. It did nothing, basically. The Election Commission is a complete joke. Then after 9/11, there was a feeling that we had to find out who's in this country, because there's something like 20 million people that are in this country that are unaccounted for or aren't in the system. There was a call for a national ID card. That went nowhere because civil libertarians think that's a bad idea. But if you had, like they do in Mexico, an ID card, that gets rid of the whole idea. You can't be accused of election fraud and not being who you are, showing up at the polls, because the government says that you are who you are. So we don't even want to go there. And then, of course, now we have this situation with the Russians where it doesn't seem like at least the Republican Party is particularly interested in solving this problem. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, if you want to solve any of those problems, can't you just solve it all at once and get rid of this canard about election fraud?
I think that there's a lot mixed in that particular bucket. And I don't want to put all of the blame on particularly responding to foreign interference on one particular political party. The sanctions that were passed and still remain unimplemented against Russia were passed by a Republican Congress. There are plenty of state election officials who have taken the money that they were given from the federal government, which has now run out. More money would be exceedingly welcome in this respect, to increase the security of their own roles, of their own election systems, of buying new equipment. You know, there aren't many people out there who are still running computers that are 18, 20, 30 years old. But the voting systems in many states are precisely that old, are well past the end of their useful life. State and local officials have been doing what they can with the resources they've been provided, and the Department of Homeland Security has been assisting cybersecurity efforts, again, against foreign interference, where they've been able to, where they've been invited to do so by state and local officials, many of whom are also Republicans. So I don't think, I think that the political will amounts to something of a failure from the office of the president, certainly one of the most prominent Republicans out there. But in steps both small and large, in steps both political and technological, I think that there are many entities working to better secure the election process. I would wish that the president would show quite a bit more leadership in that regard. And if not leadership, if we can't hope for that, then I would at least hope he would follow where everyone else seems to be heading.
Right. But the point I wanted to make, just in closing there, Justin, is that they're not mutually exclusive. You can fix the election system and make it safe and secure. At the same time, make it more accessible and open, because our national shame is that so few of us vote.
That's entirely correct. And I think you see wide bipartisan agreement, by the way, on matters of election security, again, below the level of the president, when the security measures being considered don't impact the ability of eligible Americans to cast and count a valid ballot. You see lots of agreement across the board, independent of party and with parties working together, of ways to do exactly as you say, to do both, to take steps that incrementally secure the election process without shutting real people out. There are policy solutions for that. There are technological solutions for that. Frankly, I would wish that we would have a little more civic education in a bipartisan fashion to help people process the news they receive as a means to supplement some of the technological-based security that I'm discussing here. But below the office of the presidency, I think people recognize more or less across the board that we can be doing more and should be doing more. The political will to put more money into the problem and the political will to execute some of those solutions has been fairly strong and should be a whole lot stronger still, both for 2018 and to the indefinite future. The 2018 elections are not the only elections where foreign interference is going to be a concern.
Well, Justin Levitt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks very much, Ian. I appreciate it.
I do too. And again, I've been speaking with Justin Levitt, who is an Associate Dean for Research and a Professor of Law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law and was formerly a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining another aspect of testimony today from the intelligence chiefs, with the Director of National Intelligence describing our broken system for issuing security clearances that has a current government-wide backlog of 700,000 applications.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, closer. Whisper in your ear, do-da-da. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. Ooh. I've known a secret for
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Josh Gerstein, who's a senior White House reporter for Politico, specializing in national security issues. Previously, he was a reporter at the New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News, and part of CNN's investigative unit. And he has an article at Politico, FBI Director Puts Responsibility for Porter on White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Gerstein.
Hey, good to be here.
And Josh, the Senate Intelligence Committee had hearings today. A lot of it was about the headlines have been about how the Russians hacked the 2016 election, and we're told that they will do the same in 2018. But there was also a considerable amount of discussion about the clearance situation in terms of the White House and Rob Porter. And of course, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, was quite alarming. He told the Senate Intelligence Committee that there's currently a government-wide backlog of 700,000 security clearance applications, and the process is broken. It needs to be reformed. It's not evolution, it's revolution. So what's the problem here?
Well, there's a couple different problems. One is that, you know, that process is incredibly backed up. There are these 700,000 clearances in the system. Some of it has to do with how many people in government and in private contractors have access to classified information. By some estimates, I've seen numbers of a couple million people. Of course, that includes people in the military as well. So that system has been dysfunctional and problematic for a period of years. The backlog is enormous, and it takes a long time to process these issues. That said, I would say that's almost a distinct issue from the problems being discussed about the Trump White House and the handling of clearances for top officials. Typically, those senior officials have their clearances moved to the top of the pile. So you're not there affected as much by the backlog as the question of whether these things are being handled appropriately and efficiently and what decisions are being made. And that's really where the White House finds itself in a tough spot at the moment. As recently as yesterday, they were trying to suggest that the delays regarding the clearance of the White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter, who's now resigned, that those delays were basically the fault, or at least the ball was in the court of the FBI. But the FBI Director Chris Wray said at this hearing that they had responded, and basically they thought that the overall investigation was completed by July of last year, and there were a couple follow-up matters, but that the White House had all the basic information by last July. And this has caused a revision already in the White House's statement on this, saying that, you know, they're now acknowledging that during some of this period, the issue was actually pending at an office they're calling the White House Personnel Security Office, which is apparently part of the White House. So they're now saying that the White House did have some role in whatever delays took place in the adjudication of Rob Porter's clearance.
But is there a double standard where the White House can get people cleared, at least on a temporary basis, whereas in the rest of the intelligence world, with defense contractors and others and contractors in general, it's slow? And I assume that basically, if you can't get a clearance, you can't get a job.
Yeah, I mean, there's something of a double standard. I think it's not just the White House, but other senior positions in government where they are able to get interim clearances for people. It's not just political officials, but also career folks that are hired into those jobs. the main question that I've heard here is why this interim clearance went on for so long. Folks say it is a rather uncommon for someone a year, 13 months into their service to still be under an interim clearance. And one thing people are looking at is, you know, in this case, did the White House not want to confront the, you know, politically uncomfortable and personally uncomfortable decision of basically, you know, sitting down face to face with Rob Porter, sorting out this situation and perhaps asking him to leave. And it sounds like that may have been what went on, that he was well liked within the White House, and that therefore people either intentionally or unintentionally dragged their feet in resolving this situation before it sort of burst into the public press and essentially caused him to be forced out.
And again, I'm speaking with Josh Gerstein, who's a senior White House reporter for Politico, specializing in national security issues. Previously, he was a reporter for The New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News, and part of CNN's investigative unit. And he has an article at Politico, FBI director puts responsibility for Porter on White House. But I've talked to former intelligence officials and operatives who say that the stuff that passes through Rob Porter's hands is the most sensitive intelligence in the entire U.S. world of secrecy. And clearly the concern is that if he's an accused wife beater, he could be blackmailed.
Right. I mean, that's one of the concerns. He certainly would have access to very sensitive information as staff secretary. You're basically someone managing the information and paper flow into the Oval Office. I'm not sure how much of a role he would have in the most sensitive military type and national security deliberations, but certainly he would be cleared to have access to that kind of information. It's not like he would be kicked out of meetings, I don't think, if there was something going on and those kinds of issues came up. And so normally you would think that this kind of issue would be adjudicated. That said, I have to say I'm aware of some instances in prior administrations where people who were seen as critical continued working for some period of time with one of these interim clearances while the authorities worked through these issues. And so I think we need a little bit more detail on the timeline and who was responsible for these various delays and decisions to defer some sort of final action here before we can completely apportion blame for what happened.
Well, just in closing, Josh Gerstein, is there any connection between the fact that the head of FBI counterintelligence apparently went to Jared Kushner some time back and warned him about his friendship with Wendy Deng, the former wife of Rupert Murdoch, who's also apparently had an affair with the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, which broke up the marriage, from my understanding, with Murdoch. Is that in any way related to the fact that they're dragging, the FBI dragging their heels on giving Kushner a clearance?
I mean, I doubt that it's, I tend to doubt that it's directly related. I think they probably would have had to give him that kind of a warning regardless, but it does indicate the kind of information that he has access to. You mentioned the presidential daily brief. Obviously, he's working essentially as a Middle East envoy for the administration, which would you would think would mean he would have access to a lot of fairly detailed intelligence about issues, say, like the Iranian nuclear program, other things that are considered very, very highly classified. And so, you know, we've heard that there's as many as 20 to 30 people in the White House complex who may be operating on this kind of an interim clearance. And it's going to be very interesting now that this issue is really in the spotlight, how the White House manages to resolve those 20 to 30 cases, particularly if they involve people who are the president, as I say, thinks of fondly, and in some instances may in fact be the president's own family members.
Well, but Jared Kushner's also got a lot of business dealings, and he's got a building, 666 Fifth Avenue, that's underwater. There's a lot of concern. Remember Bill Casey, when he was appointed by Reagan at the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, he didn't want to put his stuff into a blind trust. And the argument has always been that if you get a top secret clearance and you have access to the best intelligence in the country, you can't be using that information to get rich off it. And that was the concern with Bill Casey. And surely that concern exists to some extent with Jared Kushner.
Yeah, I think it does, although it's a little bit different. It's a question of whether that's a security issue or an ethics issue, I think. And so I'm sure that's one of the issues they're working through at the moment. Kushner has, while it's not a blind trust as I understand it, he's got something similar to what the president has arranged, where at least theoretically they're claiming that he's not directing any of his business enterprises. But obviously he still knows what those business enterprises are. And for projects like the one you're talking about, the Fifth Avenue building that they own, he must at least read the newspaper stories at a minimum about the difficulties they're having with that, with the financing of that project. And so I think it's a fair question, you know, where his loyalties would lie in that situation, whether that's something the FBI is ultimately going to adjudicate or other ethics officials within the White House. I think we'll have to wait and see.
Well, Josh Gerstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to do it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Josh Gerstein, who's a senior White House reporter for Politico, specializing in national security issues. Previously, he was a reporter at the New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News, and part of CNN's investigative unit. And he has an article at Politico, FBI Director Puts Responsibility for Porter on White House. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Cole, discussing his new book just out, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you'll give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian.
This is the one we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at. So who's going to account for these sins?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Steve Cole, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New America Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and is currently a staff writer for the New Yorker, the author of seven other books, including The Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Cole.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be here.
And the book covers the whole war. This is America's longest war, 17 years and going. So let's start with some of the extraordinary revelations in your book, starting with the first bombs that dropped after 9/11 on Afghanistan. You say that Mullah Omar and his coterie of top leadership could have been wiped out?
Yeah, the CIA had been watching his house in Kandahar before the air war began on October 7th, 2001. It was a well-known location, and he was there. And they had a drone with Hellfire missiles above Mullah Omar's house. And the book describes this kind of misadventure that night where they were planning to strike him, but they could never quite get a decision made. The command was fractured. The CIA wasn't really in charge. The military wasn't sure that they could hit him when they had him because of rules of that come from the Bush administration about not striking religious facilities. And eventually he got away. And, you know, a couple of months later, Osama bin Laden got away at Tora Bora. And so a consequence of an otherwise, you know, lightning strike successful war in 2001 in knocking over the Taliban's government, you know, scattering al-Qaeda, was that two very important leaders escaped to Pakistan, and the war kind of gradually shifted in that direction.
So Directorate S, of course, is this secret unit within the ISI, the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency of the Pakistan military. And, of course, the longstanding joke is that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. Mm. And my sense in the broadest sense is that Pakistan plays a pretty insidious game with the U.S. Basically, they're saying, you know, we're a nuclear power, the fastest growing nuclear power in the world, but we also have a problem with an insurrection and jihadis. So you, the United States, have got to give us money to stabilize our country because we don't want our nuclear weapons falling in the hands of the very jihadis who the state sponsors, nurtures, trains, and sets loose on all kinds of people, including the United States. A friend of mine at Georgetown, Chris Fares, describes this as a self-licking ice cream. How would you describe it?
I think you've described it well. I mean, in a way, Pakistan has used its nuclear deterrent to enlarge the sphere in which it can make mischief. And this is a kind of an interesting aspect of nuclear deterrence. It used to be that deterrence theory was about making sure another nuclear power didn't attack you for fear of escalation. But with these weaker states in rough neighborhoods like Pakistan's, nuclear deterrence has convinced the army and ISI that they can get away with nurturing militias and pursuing proxy wars and dirty wars across their borders in a way they almost certainly could not get away with if they didn't have nuclear weapons. And then the nuclear weapons are not a threat. It's not a threat that they're going to use them against the United States. It's the threat that they'll fall into the wrong hands, that the state is so weak that you have to be careful not to destabilize it. And it is insidious because the state is responsible for the very weakness that it uses in this way by mostly since the 1980s, with CIA collaboration during the 1980s, learning that these Islamist guerrillas and proxy forces could, in fact, unsettle India. In a kind of asymmetric contest in which Pakistan is the weaker state, right? Smaller in population, smaller industrial base, and they've used these guerrillas as a way to keep India off balance.
So your book, Director S, also tells the diplomatic story along with the military story, both of which, of course, are, again, we are in a situation today where we can't say that we're going to win or we're making any progress, but all we can say is that if we don't stay, it'll get a lot worse. So it's not exactly a great deal for the American taxpayer in America's longest war, and I don't know what the bill so far is. But I recall that Richard Holbrook, when he first got that portfolio as a special envoy, thought about going to the source, if you will, to solve Kashmir, and therefore that would be the beginning of kind of, if you solve the external threat, or at least the perception of threat that the Pakistanis have about India, then maybe they're not going to be destabilizing Afghanistan because of their fear of Indian mischief causing them to fight a two-front war. But I understand that it was the Indian lobby not in Washington that stymied that. Would that have worked, do you think?
Well, the timing was a little bit off, but I mean, the theory is understandable. There was a time in around 2006 when India and Pakistan in a different era did come close to settling quite a lot of their grievances around Kashmir, territorial grievances in the Siachen Glacier and Sir Creek and a framework for a kind of political future for Kashmir that would be nonviolent. And it fell apart because President Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan, his government collapsed because of his own domestic political failures. And so by the time Holbrooke came in, you know, Pakistan was in the throes of the worst domestic terrorism that it's ever known. I mean, there were car bombings in major cities. The Pakistani Taliban had been born. They had assassinated Benazir Bhutto. There just wasn't stable enough ground in Pakistan to negotiate a big detente with India. I mean, Holbrooke did poke around at it. He tried to persuade the Indians to be part of the solution. But in the end, the bolder effort that he conceived and that after he died in December 2010, others carried on was to negotiate directly with the Taliban to see if they could develop some kind of path to reduce the violence in the war and maybe even negotiate Taliban participation in Afghan politics. And so the book tells this, you know, this really, I had covered some of it, but I tried to get really underneath the surface of the negotiation. The Taliban appointed a representative of their political commission to negotiate with the Americans. And they negotiated with him for almost 2.5 years on and off, a number of meetings, exchanged quite a lot of information and ideas about how to go forward. The Taliban's position was, we don't want to be an ISI client. Yes, we are vulnerable to Pakistan. Our families live in Pakistan. We need Pakistani passports and identity cards. You know, that's where our homes are. But we see ourselves as Afghans, and we don't want them negotiating for us. We want you to negotiate with you directly. Americans said, well, okay, we recognize that. Let's talk. But ultimately, any settlement is going to have to bring ISI in. And so they were in this very complicated position. ISI was furious that the Americans were talking to their clients, the Taliban, without their involvement, and they tried to sabotage the effort from time to time. And the whole thing blew up. Part of the reason was what I just described. Part was the estrangement between President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan and the Obama administration. Karzai also didn't trust this negotiation. But, you know, the United States did learn something from the attempt. And these long, long wars that are stalemated like this one is, apart from just packing up and going home and letting the chaos run its course, the only other alternative ever is negotiating some kind of reduction of violence.
And again, Steve Collins joined me in the studio. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New America Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and is currently a staff writer for the New Yorker, the author of seven other books, including The Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, the U.S., I think, pretty clearly bungled the election and during the Obama administration, as much as I've spoken to Peter Galbraith about it. I was working for the UN at the time. He had the temerity of saying there was some fraud.
Yes.
Instead of dealing with the fraud, they fired him.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, obviously this Karzai was a restaurateur, wasn't he, or something?
His brothers were.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't seem like a great choice to begin with. But then once he realized that the U.S. didn't wanted him out or weren't, you know, too happy with him, he became more and more sour on them. This current guy doesn't seem to be doing much better neither, does he?
No. He was also the product of a fraud-riddled election, right, that was a crisis of the same type as the 2009 one. And the solution was kind of patched together through Band-Aid diplomacy, but it hasn't really taken. Right. And he's estranged from Abdullah, his own prime minister. You know, the mistake with Karzai was avoidable. I think, you know, Richard Holbrooke came in and started trying to find an alternative to Karzai, and Karzai immediately saw that the Americans wanted him replaced, but there was no plan to actually replace him. So you ended up with the worst of both worlds. He was reelected for 5 years, and he was furious that the Americans no longer saw him as an ally or a reliable partner. And there's this scene in the book where Karzai is walking in the garden of his palace with one of his ministers, and the minister says, you know, Mr. President, the Americans have been unfair to you. They originally called you an Afghan Mandela. Now they call you an Afghan Mugabe. But, you know, we have to also take responsibility for some of our own mistakes. But Karzai increasingly was so estranged that he would say wild things in private to his colleagues. You know, the Americans can just leave. I'll call the Taliban back. We'll make an alliance with the Taliban. And this minister said to him, you know, Mr. President, if the Taliban come back, if the Americans go, it's not going to affect the United States that much, but we will be all wiped out. And so that's what kept him on side.
Well, it obviously, though, is a rentier state. Has been and probably always will be. So it leads you to ask the question that when they had their victory, notwithstanding that they could have got Mullah Ramo and Osama bin Laden, I don't know whether there would have been another way around it by simply not trying to throw good money after bad on trying to build something that has never existed and perhaps would never work. But you'll never get anywhere, obviously, and this is what the book makes clear, particularly with this secret part of the ISI Directorate S, as long as the Pakistanis are thwarting you at every turn, which is what they've done. So at the end of the day, what is their end game? Because you'd think they'd be concerned about reverse sanctuary from destabilized Afghanistan pouring back into their country, which is hardly that stable to begin with. What are they thinking here?
Well, during the period described in the book, particularly, say, the period from 2007 up toward the present, But their main priority was to restore domestic security, because they'd lost control of the militant groups that they had suckered for so long, and they had turned against the Pakistani state, and tens of thousands of Pakistanis died in this terrorism campaign, security services, security forces, and militants and civilians. And so their main objective for a good while, I think, was to push the trouble out of Pakistan back into Afghanistan, in their view, from where it had come after the U.S. invaded and al-Qaeda fled into Pakistan, lashed up with these local groups, and set off this campaign against the Pakistani state. So I think first it was about stability. Now, the Americans would come to them as Pakistan slowly started to get control back over its own territory, and they would ask the question you ask, well, what do you really want? What's your end game? And for a while, Ashraf Ghani, who was the former head of ISI, now the most powerful man in Pakistan during the years of this book, the head of the army, he would say, we want a friendly government in Afghanistan. Okay, so the Americans heard that, the Afghans heard that, and they thought, oh, you want to control us again. You want the Taliban back in power. And they would challenge Ghani. So you're telling us you need to own politics in Afghanistan? That's not acceptable to the Afghan people. Then Ghani revised his position. He said, well, I'm sorry if you misunderstood my friendly to meaning influenced. I just want stability. And we don't want the Taliban back in power. We don't think that's good for us. But we need more of a balanced arrangement in Afghanistan where the Taliban have participation. And so that so that all these Afghan Taliban that have taken refuge in my country can go home and participate and not cause trouble here in Pakistan. So that was the basis of, okay, well, we can talk about that. Even Karzai said, well, let's talk about that. And Karzai was tempted, often, you know, invited by Pakistan into a separate deal with Pakistan. Well, let's forget about the Americans. Let's just cut a deal here in our neighborhood. But it never took. I guess my own reading of the Pakistani leadership is that they tend to have a condescending attitude towards Afghanistan, and they don't actually understand their own neighbor as well as they think they do. They overreach, and they continually pick bad clients, the Taliban, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar of an earlier generation. And they don't understand that Afghans themselves have become very nationalistic. And the one thing Pakistan's interference has really done is to try to bring Afghans together, especially young Afghans, in opposition.
Well, of course, we don't have a particularly stellar record.
No, that's right. Yes, that's right.
But you know, given that Afghanistan is landlocked, and the lanes in there, the SLOCs or whatever they call them, are completely controlled by Pakistan, mm-hmm. and occasionally they've jerked our chain by having these trains of trucks interrupted. My understanding is that there was a possibility of working with the Iranians, and the Iranians and the Indians have built a road from the Persian Gulf all the way up to Herat. Mm-hmm. And so is that a case of a missed opportunity? Not that it's dealing with the Iranians is easy, but was that something that we could have looked at? Because we had, you know, we did it through the north, through the Russians, and they gouged us mercilessly. And now, of course, the Russians are actually helping and funding and arming the Taliban. So,
Well, I mean, the Iranians, remember on 9/11, when we first looked at the Afghan war that we were about to wage, our allies were also allies of the Iranians. When the CIA teams first went into the Panjshir Valley and started to prepare the Northern Alliance for the coming war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, who did they find? They found Indians there running hospitals and supporting the Northern Alliance. They found Russians there selling helicopters and providing some aid to keep the Taliban, you know, a little bit at bay. And they found a lot of Iranians because, you know, there are cultural, linguistic, ethnic ties between those populations of Afghanistan and Iran. And the Iranians were at the Bonn Accords. They were constructive, even with the Bush administration's kind of axis of evil rhetoric. They hung in there and supported the new arrangements in Afghanistan for their own interests, for their own reasons. But, you know, they didn't, in those days, they didn't see the Taliban as something that they wanted to be revived. They had almost gone to war with the Taliban in 2000. There's sectarian and other differences there. But they gradually, of course, we gradually ratcheted up our hostility toward Iran, and the reformist government yielded to, you know, a more ardent nationalistic government in Ahmadinejad's era. And, you know, we were as blinded by our enmity toward Iran as anything else in the region. So that promise of common interests mm-hmm. and alternatives to reliance on Pakistan dissolved gradually in the years after the Bonn Accords. But the interests haven't really shifted. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the Iranians see our military presence there as threatening to them, so they would like us out. But ultimately, they have as much of an interest in a stable, sustainable Afghanistan, including one that's influenced by their brethren from the north and the west, as any other neighbor does.
So what is India's role? India does have a role. We know that whether or not it's mendacious or benign, the Pakistanis are completely paranoid about it.
Yep.
So short of making a deal with Iran and having at least an alternative how to supply this landlocked country, what about somehow getting India to, you know, either cooperate with or at least remove the paranoia? Because at the end of the day, I don't see any other situation except we'll go back to perhaps an even worse situation than we had before 9/11.
That's right. Well, I mean, the Pakistanis have, I think, you know, over the years overstated India's presence in Afghanistan, and they have been paranoid about it. But it's a little bit also like the old, you know, joke, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean India's not out to get you. I mean, they are involved with some of the insurgents inside Pakistan in a tit-for-tat way. I think, you know, India has its own longstanding history in Afghanistan. It has economic interests. It has regional interests. It's not as if Pakistan can wish India out of Afghanistan entirely, although that hasn't stopped them from demanding it from time to time. But the real opportunity is for India to cooperate with the international community, the United States, the region, in supporting a settlement that includes Pakistan and isn't a zero-sum game. You know, the Indians have been cautious about their involvement in Afghanistan because they know the Pakistanis are paranoid, and they don't want to provoke Pakistan into launching terrorist strikes inside India in some kind of retaliation for imagined Indian mischief in Afghanistan. And so they, you know, for example, the Afghans have talked about, well, let's do more military training with the Indians, and let's have more Indian forces join the kind of stabilization effort. And the Indians have been, look, we have enough problems convincing Pakistan not to send terrorist cells into our country or to try to stir up our own Muslim population. Afghanistan isn't worth that price, so we're going to moderate our involvement. They've used soft power more than kind of hard power in Afghanistan. They've let us carry the weight of the counterterrorism campaign.
Well, Steve Cole, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Cole, who's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He was president of the New American Foundation and worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize, and currently is a staff writer for The New Yorker, the author of 7 other books, including the Bin Ladens and Private Empire. His latest book just out is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.